Our text for this morning is Psalm 73. Beloved congregation in our Lord Jesus Christ, this psalm is the first psalm in the third book of the Psalter. That book of the Psalter consists of Psalms 73 to 89. One of the striking characteristics of that book of the Psalter is that many of the psalms of that book are psalms of Asaph. In fact, Psalms 73 to 83 are all psalms of Asaph. And outside of this book of the Psalter, this third book of the Psalter, there's only one psalm that is ascribed to Asaph, and that's Psalm 50. In addition, only one of the psalms of this book is described as a psalm of David, that's Psalm 86. All the rest of the psalms then belong either to the sons of Korah or to Ethan the Ezrahite. Asaph was one of the three Levitical singers whom David appointed to be over the service of song in the temple. You can read about that in 1 Chronicles 15. But there is a problem with that idea that he is the author of these psalms. If you look at Psalm 74, for example, you'll see that that psalm seems to belong to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem by the army of King Nebuchadnezzar. Look at verse 3. Of that psalm, lift up your feet to the perpetual desolations. The enemy has damaged everything in the sanctuary. And the same is true of Psalm 79. In verse 1 of that psalm, Asaph sings, O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. Your holy temple they have defiled. They have laid Jerusalem in heaps. So the solution to this problem, to my mind, is either that there were two Asaphs, the Asaph that wrote these psalms at the time of David, and another, some of these psalms at the time of Asaph, and another Asaph who wrote some of these psalms later, or that all of these psalms were written by a later Asaph than the one whom David appointed. However, when you look at Psalm 73, this psalm does not even need an historical setting in order to understand it. This is a psalm, in fact, about a problem that confronts all of God's people at one time or another in their life and is equally fitting to any period of the history of the Church of Jesus Christ in the world. Every one of God's people can readily understand the basic idea of this psalm and the problem with which it deals. It is the problem of the prosperity of the wicked. I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked, Asaph says. The psalm is divided into three parts by the word surely or truly. In verse 1, you read, surely or truly, God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart. Then again in verse 18, surely you set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. And then again in verse 18, that verse 18 is the third part. The second part begins in verse 13. Surely I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence. So you have those three parts, each of which begins with the word surely, a strong affirmation. And notice how different those affirmations are. Surely God is good to Israel. Surely I have cleansed my heart in vain. Surely you have set them in slippery places. So we consider the psalm under the theme, the problem of the prosperity of the wicked. First of all, the problem stated in verses 1 to 12. Secondly, the turning point in verses 13 to 17. And thirdly, the resolution of the problem in verses 18 to 28. Asaph begins the psalm, therefore, with a strong affirmation of a basic fact. Truly, God is good to Israel. That is a fact that is constantly active, constantly true in the life of his people. It's something that Asaph makes no attempt to deny. God has been good to Israel in the past. He chose her out of all the nations of the world to be his own people. He made her strong and numerous in the land of Egypt. He brought her out of the land of Egypt under the hand of Moses. He gave her his gracious law at Mount Sinai. He brought her through the wilderness and gave to her the inheritance of a land flowing with milk and honey. He has established her in that land and given to her many, many blessings there. His goodness is an indisputable fact in the nation of Israel. In addition to this, Asaph understands, as he makes clear in this first verse, that even within the nation of Israel, there has to be a distinction made between the righteous and the wicked. Israel is chosen to be the people of God, but within that people of God, there are those who are pure in heart and those who are not pure in heart. And God's goodness is for those who are pure in heart. God is, in other words, the implication here is God is not good to the wicked. God is not good to the wicked, even among his people Israel. He is good to such as are pure in heart. These are facts operating in the life of Israel, in the life of all those who are pure in heart, and they are facts which Asaph does not dispute. He begins with the affirmation, the strong affirmation of these facts. And yet he says, verse 2, I have a problem. But as for me, the Hebrew there is simply and I, but it always indicates a contrast with what has gone before. So, but as for me is a very good translation of it. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. In other words, Asaph is saying here, in spite of this goodness of God to Israel, I have been so powerfully tempted that I have very nearly stumbled and slipped. He may well mean here by this, people of God, that he has come very, very close to denying his faith altogether and to forsaking the Lord. And why is it? Because he has seen the prosperity of the wicked and he has become envious of them. But I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They are wicked men. They are boastful men. That is, they're men of pride. But Asaph, confessing his sin, it is a confession of sin here, but it's a confession of sin rooted in a problem that still exists in his own heart, the problem of the prosperity of the wicked. He looks around him and he sees that wicked men prosper in their wickedness and in their pride, and that he does not, and he becomes envious of them. Envy is, of course, a form of covetousness. It's not the only form of covetousness, but it's one form of covetousness. It's that form of covetousness which desires for oneself what another person has. And because it desires for itself what another person has, this envy then is discontented with one's own present circumstances, discontented with the providence of God, discontented with the wisdom of God in one's own life, setting one's hope not on the promises and goodness of God as they exist for me at this moment, but rather setting one's hope, fixing one's attention on some future state or possible future state and saying, I can be contented and I can be happy only if I have that. I can't be contented and happy now in God's way with me. I must have that, that other person has, before I can be contented and happy. That's envy. It looks at another and it says, that person has better things than I do, and I need those things. At the very least, I need those things if I'm going to be at all happy. I cannot, it's impossible for me to be contented with God's way with me right now, here, in these circumstances. In verses 4 and following, then, he describes this prosperity of the wicked. It's described especially in verses 4 and 5. There are no pangs in their death. Their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. There are no pangs in their death. I think that means simply, people of God, that from Asaph's perspective, it looks like their deaths are easy. They're not, during this life, burdened with all sorts of pangs. That is, burdened with all sorts of troubles and temptations and stresses and sorrows and so on that seem to be constantly weighing down, constantly pressing one down towards death. They are not, as it were, captives of death, being dragged unwillingly along the way to death. But their strength is firm, or as the New American Standard, I think, has it, their belly is fat. The ideas of those two translations are essentially the same, I think. Their strength is firm. Their belly is fat. That is, they have an easy and prosperous life here in the world, and when death comes to them, it seems to come easily, quietly. They maybe slip away quietly in their sleep. They're not in trouble as other men. Nor are they plagued like other men. They seem to be in a class by themselves, set apart from other men and free from the troubles and plagues and chastenings that come upon other men. They're privileged people. Somehow they're privileged people, distinguishing them from other men. Now, as we look at that description of the prosperity of the wicked, I think we have to say, people of God, that there is in that picture of the prosperity of the wicked some distortion of the reality. This is not the full truth, at least, about these wicked men. They're not entirely free from trouble. Their deaths are not always easy. They're not always free from diseases and troubles and plagues and so on that come upon other men. That's simply going too far. Nevertheless, Asaph is getting at here a truth, an observable fact, which is not only something that he has seen, but which many of the people of God have seen throughout the ages. In Psalm 37, David complains about it. In Psalm 49, we have another example. In Jeremiah 12, Jeremiah complains about it. In, I think it's Haggai chapter 1, Haggai, the prophet, complains about the same problem. This is an ongoing problem for the people of God. They look around them and they see the prosperity of the wicked, and they look at themselves and they say, I'm full of troubles and anguish and sorrows and temptations and pains. I'm always struggling against my sins. I'm always fighting against the inclinations of my flesh. I'm always subject to all these different troubles. Life is a constant battle for me, and it seems to be so easy for them. And in a certain sense, it's true. Satan's not particularly concerned about them. They're already securely in his hand. He's much more concerned about us who are not securely in his hand. And God, God is not concerned so much about them either in the long run. As Asaph says later, as a dream when one awakes, so Lord, when you awake, you shall despise their image. But he is concerned about us. Though Asaph doesn't understand that yet at this point. But the result, one of the results of this prosperity of the wicked then is that they're proud. Verse 6, therefore pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. They wear pride like a necklace. It's not just that they are proud, but they wear their pride like a necklace. It's an ornament to them. They're proud of their pride, if we may put it that way. And because of their pride, they're also, of course, violent towards others. They don't care about others. They care about themselves, their prosperity, their ease, their privileges. And they think that in their prosperity and in their privileges, they may freely use others to their own advantage. So violence covers them like a garment. We've seen examples of that very recently, haven't we, in the accusations that have been made against prominent people by various women. Their eyes bulge with abundance. Now that could be taken as simply a physical description. They're so fat that their eyes stand out. That kind of idea. But Calvin points out, and I think probably rightly, that this probably means a lot more than that. This is part of their pride. They're sleek and self-satisfied. That's the sense in which their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than heart could wish, or again, if you look at the New American Standard Translation, the imaginations of their hearts run riot. The imaginations of their hearts run riot. That is, they don't see any reason in themselves to restrain their schemings, their plans, their thoughts, their desires. They let their hearts run freely over all kinds of ideas, no matter how wicked they are, and no matter how injurious to others. They don't care about that. They're concerned and wrapped up in themselves. And so, too, their mouths are out of control. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily, or they speak from on high. They speak as if they're better than other men. And as if the words of their mouths are words that ought to be heard by others, as the ultimate in wisdom. Though they're men of earth, they set their mouth against the heavens even. And their tongue walks through the earth. They have something to say about everything and to everyone in every kind of circumstance. These are the great men of earth, the men who think that they have wisdom, they have power, they have privilege, they have everything that other men do not have. They are a privileged class. They are the wonderful people of the earth. Let everybody else kowtow to them and listen to what they have to say. They're proud. That's the basic idea. But a second result of this then is found in verses 10 and 11. Therefore, his people return here, and waters of a full cup are drained by them, and they say, how does God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? There are disagreements about what that actually means. Some say that his people means those who are associated with these wicked men. They are then their servants or employees, their associates and their friends, even their hangers-on. And what the verses mean then is to say that these people who are around these prosperous, wicked people attach themselves to them in such a way as to participate in their prosperity. Waters of a full cup are drained by them. And then also to become partakers of their pride, and ultimately to say, as they would say, how does God know, and is there knowledge in the Most High? In other words, they're saying along with the wicked man in Psalm 10. He has said in his heart, God has forgotten. He hides his face. He will never see. Or verse 13, why do the wicked renounce God? He has said in his heart, you will not require an account. They simply deny that God can see their wickedness, and so to them their wickedness doesn't matter. God does not know about it. They can go freely on their way, doing whatever they please, enjoying their prosperity. But others say that this his people means God's people, or at least those who belong to the nation of Israel. Therefore, God's people return here, and waters of a full cup are drained by them. And then again, these who take this as a reference to God's people say there's two possibilities about this. One is that these are people of the nation of Israel who are not pure in heart, and whose hearts are set on the things of this world, and who see the prosperity of the wicked, and who are drawn away from God by that prosperity of the wicked, and enjoy that prosperity along with the wicked. Waters of a full cup are drained by them. And they too then join with the wicked ultimately in saying, how does God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? This is a kind of mocking statement. God doesn't have knowledge that will be a threat to us in our circumstances, in our wickedness. And others say, no, that's not right. These are the pure in heart that the psalmist is talking about here. They come to the same conclusions. They return here to the same conclusions that Asaph draws. And waters of a full cup are drained by them. That is, they have a full cup of affliction and sorrows. And they then ask with Asaph, how does God know? It's not a mocking statement anymore, but a statement of distress. Does God really know what's going on? These wicked are so prosperous, and I so full of sorrow. How does God know? Is there really knowledge in the Most High? Does he understand what's happening to me? I'm rather inclined to the second of these positions, people of God, though I'm not sure one can prove any one of them. And I'm rather inclined to the second position, that is that these are people of Israel who are drawn away from God by the prosperity of the wicked, and who join them in enjoying that prosperity, and who say along with them, how does God know? Mockingly. And I'm inclined to that position because of verse 12. Behold, these are the ungodly who are always at ease. They increase in riches. I think up to this point then, the psalmist has been discussing the ungodly, including in verses 10 and 11. These are the ungodly, he says. They're wicked. They're proud. Their tongue walks through the earth. They do violence to others. They have prosperity in their wickedness. Not only do they have prosperity in their wickedness, but God even seems to increase their wealth. They increase in riches. They have ease. They're full of all good things. And life seems to continue on that track for them indefinitely. But here we come to our second point. I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence. Here is where that envy comes in, isn't it? Asaph says, I see it now. I see this prosperity of the wicked. I see their freedom from the pangs of death. I see their freedom from plagues and chastenings and troubles. The only conclusion I can draw is that I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence. I've been struggling all of my life to clean up my life inwardly, my heart, and outwardly, my hands. I've been struggling against sin and temptation. I've tried to live purely and godly before my God. And it's all been in vain. I get no good from it. God rewards the wicked and punishes me. All day long I have been plagued and chastened every morning. What's the use of continuing in this righteousness if this is what is going to happen to me? Notice that in that first line of verse 14, he uses the very same word that he had used of the wicked in verse 5. Nor are they plagued like other men. And here, all day long, I have been plagued. My lot has been exactly the opposite of theirs. And it's every single day, every morning, I wake up to new chastenings, new troubles, new afflictions, new stresses, new anxieties. It is a strong temptation at certain times in our lives, isn't it? When the weight of our troubles weighs us down to the point that sometimes even we wish for death. It's just too much to bear anymore. And we do want to give up our faith. We look at the wicked around us and we say, they don't have these kinds of troubles. They don't seem to suffer my temptations. They're certainly not fighting against their sins every day and losing the battle and having constantly to confess their sins to God. They're not experiencing all this kind of stuff that's coming upon me. Why should I do it? Why should I struggle as I do? Let me just join them and my life will be easy as theirs are easy. If I had said thus, he goes on to say, if I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I would have been untrue to the generation of your children. What's he saying there? He's saying, I can't even talk about it. If I open my mouth to complain of all the plagues and chastenings that I have to endure, then I put at risk others of God's people. I lead them into temptation along with me. I betray them. I become treacherous to them. I can't even speak. So when I thought to understand this, it was too painful for me. It's just too much. But here, of course, suddenly comes the turning point. Until I went into the sanctuary of God. Notice two things about that, people of God. First of all, he's going into the sanctuary of God. We don't know why he went there, whether he went there actually to bring this problem before God, to confess his sin and to seek help in the struggles that he's having here in this psalm, or whether he's just going to the sanctuary of God in the ordinary course of events according to the commandments of God's law. But it doesn't really matter. The point is that he's going to make use of the means of grace that God has provided. That's the point. He went to the place where God's voice could be heard, where he could hear what God had to say in these circumstances at this time to him in his struggles. And secondly, notice, people of God, that in going to the sanctuary of God, he is acting by faith and looking no longer just at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. It's very important. Up to this point, his vision has been circumscribed and limited by what his physical eyes can see. And that's not the whole picture. He now lifts his eyes above what can be seen and looks to those things which cannot be seen, which must be grasped by faith. And then, finally, he understands. It's the same thing we see in 2 Corinthians 4 with the Apostle Paul's words. Therefore, he says, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing. He was in the same kind of trouble as Asaph was in. Yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Notice this. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. That's the turning point in Asaph's own mind. And he has come into the sanctuary of God, and that he is looking now to the things that are not seen, not just to those temporary things that are seen. And what does he see there in the sanctuary of God? That brings us to our third point, the resolution of the problem. He sees the end of the wicked. And I think, people of God, that we should not take that to mean he sees their end in the sense that he sees that in some certain cases in this life, these wicked men do suffer certain judgments of God. But he sees their final end. He sees that God sets them in slippery places and casts them down to destruction. In this, they're very unlike Asaph himself. Asaph says of himself in verse 2, my steps had nearly slipped. But his steps had nearly slipped, not because there was no ground for them to stand on. The ground was there, as he found out. But these men, their feet are slipping, and there's no ground for them to stand on. There's no place for them to plant their feet. They have all their attention focused on their prosperity and their ease and their pride and everything else. And they probably don't even know what's happening to them, but they're on a slippery slope and they're sliding down that slope. And at the foot of that slope lies the pit of destruction. You cast them down to destruction. Oh, how are they brought to desolation as in a moment? They are utterly consumed with terrors. There's only everlasting burning and consuming terrors for them in their end. God sets them in slippery places. Their prosperity is, in fact, for them, a slippery place. And by that means, God casts them down to destruction. And so, ultimately, these men are no more substantial and no more important than a dream to God. We have sometimes very vivid dreams, don't we? They seem very powerful, very important in the midst of those dreams. And then we wake up and we dismiss them. Oh, it was just a dream. It doesn't matter. It's completely insubstantial, completely ephemeral. So Asaph says, Lord, when you rouse yourself, you will despise their image. You'll dismiss them as a man dismisses his dream when he wakes from his sleep. They are that ephemeral, that insignificant. Then, of course, Asaph has to review what he himself has been doing and thinking prior to this. His envy, his trouble at his own chastenings and plagues. Why this trouble? Why this envy? My heart was grieved. I was vexed in my mind or my kidneys. I was vexed in my kidneys. But that was because I was foolish and ignorant, and because I was like a beast before you. One translator makes that first line, I was a dolt and did not know anything. And I think the Hebrew is that strong. I was a dolt and knew nothing. I was like a beast before you. I had as little understanding when I was envying the wicked as the beasts do. Remember what the scriptures say about beasts in Psalm 32. Do not be like the horse or like the mule, which have no understanding, which must be harnessed with bit and bridle, else they will not come near you. Or in Psalm 49, when the sons of Korah address this same problem, the last verse of the psalm, a man who is in honor yet does not understand is like the beasts that perish. What distinguishes man from the beast is understanding, or at least the capacity to understand, the ways and works of God. But Asaph didn't understand any more than those wicked men did. And he was like a beast because of that failure to understand. That's his confession about his envy. And still, in spite of that folly, in spite of that ignorance, in spite of that bestial lack of understanding, he says in the next verse, I am continually with you. That's the answer to his problem. I am continually with you. Now, it's very striking that here again we have a use of words which ties things together in a very interesting way. In verse 22, he really says in the Hebrew, I was like a beast with you. Very same words he uses in the next line. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. I was a beast with you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. Same words, but what a difference in meaning. He's with God, as those wicked men are not. Furthermore, while he is with God, God holds him by his right hand. Does not let him slip or fall or stray from the way. He's right there, holding him by the hand as a father holds the hand of his little child to keep him from running from his side in a crowd of people. He holds him by his right hand. Not only does he hold him to keep him safe by his side, but with that same right hand with which he holds him, he guides him. And he guides him with his counsel. I think that's a reference to the eternal counsel of God. All his life, he's basically saying, has been laid out in the eternal counsel of his heavenly Father. And now that he is living out his life here in the world, it's not as if his Father has let go his hand to let him go his own way. But his Father is holding his hand and guiding him down the path of life exactly as he had determined it from before the foundations of the world. Nothing is happening to him apart from God's knowledge. That question, how does God know and is there knowledge with the Most High, is a bad question, a question that has no meaning. Of course there's knowledge with the Most High. He has laid out the whole path of my life from eternity. And in his guidance, he has a purpose. That's the final thing that he says. He has a purpose to take me afterward to glory. This is the way of life for those who are pure in heart. Yes, they suffer more than other men. Okay, but let's look at the things which are not seen. I am continually with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel afterward to take me to glory. And so he concludes, whom have I in heaven but you? Heaven itself would be valueless if it were not for your presence there. But I have you, and that's all I need. There's none upon earth that I desire besides you. Let the wicked have their wealth and their prosperity and their ease and everything else. That's their portion. And let them enjoy it to the full. I have something better. I have God. My flesh and my heart fail. Yes, indeed they do. They're always failing. But God is the strength of my heart. Here and now, in these circumstances, and my portion forever, my hope for the future. He sums it all up then in verses 27 and 28. For indeed those who are far from you shall perish. Here's the things that are not seen about the wicked. Those who are far from you shall perish. You have destroyed all those who desert you for harlotry, all those who commit whoredom against you by forsaking you. But it's good for me to draw near to God. They're far from him, they perish. I'm near, I will draw near, and it's good for me. It is a good in itself, of course. It is that being with God that he describes earlier. But it is good also in the sense that there in the presence of God, he learns a proper perspective on life and on everything that happens to him. It's good for me to be with God because he teaches me rightly. And so I will put my trust in him and I will declare all his works. In the future, I will not let myself be troubled by the prosperity of the wicked. I will trust him. And I will declare his works. I will make public what he has done for me in private. May God bless the proclamation of his word.